Anton continually harped on the necessity of keeping her predilection for female lovers a secret, lest she derail her career. The closeted world that Audrey inhabited kept her in an itchy state and made her a better agent, nervy, edgy, and resentful. Her annual vacations abroad were delicious opportunities to spot, pursue, and bed tantalizing lovers. Anton several times had to intercede with local authorities when sessions with Audrey and a local partner became too spirited. Audrey, on the boil, occasionally became physical. Anton even arranged for forged alias identity cards to keep her true name out of local police blotters if things got out of control. The sex was a handling problem, but it was worth the bother as a tool to control Magnet, for when she was back in Washington behind her desk at ONR, the Office of Naval Research, broad stripes on her sleeves and three stars on her collar, she was by necessity benignly celibate and had to live the part. Anton even advised her to eschew battery-operated boyfriends at home because she was assigned a live-in Navy steward and cook in the gabled Victorian quarters B on Admiral's Row at the Washington Naval Yard in Southeast Washington. He sternly told her that her snow-white image as a laudably asexual professional would be sullied if her staff found any sex toys, and rumors would quickly circulate about the wild-haired three-star stoker in the attic at midnight with a 220-volt massager, making the lights flicker and scaring the mice. The same applied when Audrey one year discovered spicy Thai cucumber salad while on a temple tour in northern Thailand, and announced she would have her cook in Washington prepare it often. During their meeting in the swanky Anantara Resort in provincial Chiang Mai, Anton sternly told her to leave the contents of the reefer crisper alone. The household staff would be bound to notice missing cucumbers. Audrey laughed at the image. After so many years, Uncle Anton could talk to her about such things freely. Between her sustaining foreign meetings with Uncle Anton, Magnet met once a month in Washington with GRU handlers, who were military intel officers from the Russian embassy on Wisconsin Avenue. Covered as run-of-the-mill military attachés, GRU spooks rarely ran true clandestine sources, inhabiting instead the margins of classic intelligence elicitation, open-source collection, and technology transfer. The meetings were held in suburban parks and along nature trails and greenswards in Washington and suburban Maryland and Virginia. These meetings were little more than 5-minute brief encounters during which Audrey would pass her intel and send messages to Uncle Anton. Audrey's quantitative mind took to the challenge of finding imaginative meeting sites, ones that she could surveil from a distance to ensure the GRU dolt of the month hadn't dragged FBI surveillance with him. Audrey had discussed the fine points of site casing with Anton, her tutor, in so many things, and had become quite adept. Audrey had lost count of the endless disks, thumb drives, digital cameras, hard drives, and occasionally sheaves of physical documents, bound volumes, and printouts of every aspect of naval weapons research, anti-submarine warfare, ship design and radar, stealth technology, and encrypted communications she dumped in the laps of her handlers. After 12 years in harness, she couldn't have accurately listed the sum total of the secrets she had passed the Russians. She really didn't care. The three stripes on her uniform coat were reason enough to continue. A source such as Magnet unquestionably was the jewel of the GRU crown, as well as a constant burden on the collective abilities of GRU headquarters, commonly known as the Aquarium. From the beginning, Anton Gorelikov had been secretly assigned by Putin to monitor the Magnet case and observe the quality and durability of GRU tradecraft. When Magnet received her third star, Gorelikov none too gently began prying the case away from the military, eventually to be assigned to an illegals officer in New York, who would be anonymous, invisible, and inviolate. At that time, the Magnet cryptonym would be changed and the files tightly restricted. Gorelikov also had his eye on SVR Chief of Counterintelligence Colonel Igorova, who he thought eventually could share Magnet handling duties abroad based on her previous experience in street operations and counterintelligence. President Putin had for years been on a low simmer for his counterintelligence chief, the former busty ballerina, since the night he had visited Dominika's room in the Constantine Palace at midnight and casually fondled the lace bodice of her nightgown while ordering her to fly to Paris and eradicate her chief, the psychopath Zhuganov, who had gotten on Putin's bad side. The president had not forgotten how Igorova's nipples had responded to his touch, could not forget the faint scratching of the dockyard rivets swelling beneath the lace, and how her lashes fluttered in coy arousal. He would own her, eventually, it was inevitable. He had intentions of promoting Igorova in the near future, but not yet. And handling Magnet could wait. The mole's continued production was critical. Gorelikov assured Putin this was just the beginning. As the U.S. Navy would founder and disintegrate, so would the United States. Chtopilo, tuproshlo, ibiolum, poroslo. What used to be will be gone and overgrown with grass, said Gorelikov to Vladimir. Magnet's Spicy Thai Cucumber Salad. Peel and deseed cucumber and slice paper thin, preferably on a mandolin. Put cucumber slices in a colander, sprinkle with salt, and let drain, squeezing out excess water. In a bowl, mix rice vinegar, lime juice, thin slices of garlic, lots of finely diced Thai bird's-eye chilies, nam pla, fish sauce, chopped cilantro, a dash of sesame oil, sugar, finely diced scallions, and thinly sliced red onion. Soak onions in ice water briefly beforehand. Toss cucumbers in dressing and sprinkle with either dried shrimp powder or finely ground peanuts. Serve immediately. Chapter 3. You Are Mine. Dominika uncapped the lipstick tube and wrote T-Moy on Nathaniel Nash's naked chest as she lay on top of him in bed in CIA's safe house, a sun-blasted white stucco cottage at the end of a dusty road, at the top of a rocky cactus hill in Vouliagmeni, 15 kilometers south of Athens, with a hazy view of the island of Aegina across the dead, calm, turquoise Saronic Gulf. White island ferries heading into the port of Piraeus left intersecting foaming wakes as they passed. Outside the window, hummingbirds flitted around the blossoms of the wisteria vines that grew up the outside walls of the one-room villa. Dominika hitched herself a little higher and kissed him on the lips. "I hope that wasn't one of your lipstick guns," said Nate. 2 years earlier, SVR's Line T, technical, had given Dominika 2 electrically fired single-shot weapons disguised as lipstick tubes that she had used in Paris to separate the skull cap from the brain pan of her diminutive and psychotic chief Zhuganov, who at the time was raking her ribs with a stiletto, trying to shiver the tip of the blade between her ribs and into her heart. He had divined that Dominika was working for CIA, and when the exploding dum-dum bullets from the lipstick guns aerosolized the poison dwarf's brain into the River Seine, she was safe again for the time being, until the next crisis. That had been 5 years after her first overseas tour in Helsinki. Finland had been a dream. Gingerbread trim houses and sizzling venison cutlets and the excitement and ecstasy of a real operational mission. To find CIA officer Nathaniel Nash of the American Embassy, meet, befriend, and if necessary, seduce him to elicit the name of a high-ranking Russian the SVR knew, just knew, Nash was handling, but could never catch. Nash and Dominika started working on each other, dinners by the light of candle-wax-covered wine bottles, walks in leafy city parks, coffees along the breezy harbor promenade, the girls' summer skirts billowing above their hips. Elicitation, bone-throwing, verbal snares, and assessment traps. They both knew all the developmental tricks and banged heads for 3 months trying to recruit each other. She noted that his crimson halo, passion, devotion, constancy, never wavered or rippled. He told the truth, and she could see his interest deepening by the day. Then the impossible happened. Nate's easy, honest nature, his mild but accurate criticism of the current mess in Russia, The earnest, flirty attention he paid to her made her question what she was doing, for whom she was doing it, and why. When her friend in the Russian embassy disappeared, Dominica was positive she had been assassinated over a minor infraction of security. It pushed her over the edge. On a rainy Helsinki night, she accepted Nate's recruitment pitch to spy for CIA, and she was encrypted, Diva. How better could she do maximum damage to the Tsar and his bandits? What more could she do to feed the Otravshenye, the loathing for them she felt? By spying for CIA, Dominica was helping the Rodina, not betraying it. Boge, God, they were a different breed, these CIA men who gathered around to train her and coach her and support her like family, beneficence unheard of and impossible in her own SVR. A small group of them had come into her life. Chief of Europe Division Tom Forsyth, the salt-and-pepper-haired legend in the DO, the Directorate of Operations and beneficent mentor to Nate Nash. The urbane Forsyth had recruited prime ministers, Emirati princes, and once the pampered mistress of a Red Fleet admiral by taking her to an orphanage in Paris to watch children gamble in the playroom. Forsyth knew the admiral had refused to marry her and give her children. Recruitment was all about human needs, vulnerabilities, and motivations. Deeply affected by his solicitude, she started stealing Soviet naval secrets for Forsyth the next day. Then there was Marty Gable, career-long colleague of Forsyth. He was usually dressed in khaki bush shirt and hiking boots and slouched on a couch. There wasn't much Gable hadn't seen. He had run assets in Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and the Maghreb. He had recruited a penetration of the PKK terrorist group in Istanbul and rescued the blown agent by shooting a PKK enforcer between the eyes. To him, protecting his agents, namely Diva, came first. Dominica took to calling him Braduk, Big Brother. He had taken the young Nate under his wing, lovingly kicking Nash's ass to learn the rules of the game. The last of these new friends was Chief of Counterintelligence Simon Benford. Podgy, angry, necktie perpetually askew. Most days the hair on one side of his head stuck out in a wing, exact cause unknown. Like Forsyth, Benford was an obelisk in the DO. In the last 5 years alone, the mercurial genius had led 3 separate investigations to unmask Russian-run moles inside CIA and the U.S. government. Benford hated bureaucrats, careerists, moon calves, mutton heads most of the special agents in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the entire Defense Intelligence Agency, and what he called the homoerotic Department of State. Due to the extreme sensitivity and restricted handling protocol within the compartment, Benford became the senior headquarters officer personally directing the Diva case. Under their careful guidance, Dominica emptied the Helsinki residentura of all its secrets, and when she returned to Moscow, began reporting sensitive blue-stripe intelligence, designating the most sensitive and perishable secrets from the vaults of Yasinevo, which soon made her CIA's premier Russian source. For more than 7 years, Dominica had stolen everything she could, and her CIA men kept her sane and alive through heart-pounding personal meetings in Moscow alleyways, furtive rendezvous in foreign capitals, and abbreviated burst transmissions from her SRAC, short-range agent communications equipment. She laid open for CIA the Kremlin's clandestine activities around the world. There was also the situation with her recruiting case officer, Nathaniel Nash. Dark hair spilling across his forehead, his exceptional falcon eyes on the street, the crimson aura around his shoulders, worked cumulatively on Dominica, already dazzled by CIA men and the wild sleigh ride of spying for them. What else happened between Nate and Dominica in Helsinki perhaps was inevitable. Thrown together under the unrelenting pressure of recruitment and espionage, Nate, the agent handler, and Dominica, the clandestine asset, fell in love. Their passion was unrelenting, their lovemaking volcanic, furtive, and limited to the rare occasions they were alone together. For Nate, an affair between a case officer and his asset was a career-ending infraction. For Dominica, sleeping with Nate, the American, would be fatal if discovered by the center. Their liaison did not, could not, remain secret from CIA for long. Gable's pheromonal instincts and Benford's warlock prescience soon detected the forbidden affair. Nate was called on the carpet, but Benford chose for the moment not to fire him summarily from the service in the interest of the intel production and keeping D.Va motivated. For her part, Dominica unconcernedly acknowledged the situation, accepted the risks, ignored Bratok Gable's warnings, and reveled in her love for Nate. Nash had tried to stop the affair several times, but their passion was overwhelming. She refused to give him up, and he could not extinguish his crimson ardor. Brushing her heavy breasts across Nate's face, Dominica got out of bed and padded over to the tiled corner of the tiny kitchen that was a makeshift shower, and doused herself with the hand nozzle, wetting a substantial patch of the marble floor. Nate watched her wash her lithe body, white scars crisscrossing her ribs, ballet calves flexing as she rotated under the water. He got out of bed and joined her in the shower. Nate was muscular and thin, with unruly black hair and brown eyes that missed little. "Can you see what I wrote?" asked Dominica, soaping his chest, tracing his own scars, the brown one across his belly, the angry red furrows on his arms. They were stitched mannequins, the two of them. Nate did not answer but kissed her, holding her head in his hands, enveloping her in his red cloud. "Timoy," she said, wrapping her arms around his neck. "You are mine." "Does Vladimir Putin know?" he said. They sat on the tiny balcony of the cottage, the sun setting below the mountain behind the house. The rickety table had uneven legs and wobbled. The wicker chairs creaked loosely. They ate a peasant dinner with two oversized spoons, communally from a chipped terracotta bowl with painted blue dolphins around the rim. Nate had cooked the green beans slowly all day in olive oil with onions, garlic, and crushed tomatoes. A separate dish was piled with olives, feta, and crusty country bread. They drank cold Retsina from a bottle floating in a tin washtub with the last of the ice slurry from yesterday. The shadows on the hillside were growing longer as they talked. "All I'm saying is that it's dangerous for you to continue bouncing around the world personally recruiting North Koreans, or anyone for that matter, considering Putin could make you director of SVR soon," said Nate. They had spent the entire first day in the safe house discussing Dominica's recruitment of Professor Ri and the other intelligence Dominica had brought out of Moscow, especially the most exciting news. Dominica had told Nate that as a result of President Putin's continued sponsorship, he had hinted that he might soon promote her to the rank of general and just possibly give her the directorship of the SVR, an astounding development that Nate immediately reported to Langley on his Thresher encrypted satellite phone that was approved for limited use in NATO countries. Gobsmacked by the notion that his star agent might soon be running the SVR, Benford had spilled coffee on his tie, already liberally spotted with crab bisque and mayonnaise. In one blink, D.Va would have access to all SVR secrets, would automatically claim a seat at the National Security Council, and would become a fledgling member of the Siloviki, Putin's gaggle of insiders with access to not just secret plots roiling the halls of the Kremlin, but also the plans and intentions of the circumspect and coy Vladimir Vladimirovich, whom many foreign observers had analyzed, but few genuinely knew. "It helps, not hurts. When I acquire intelligence assets, it raises my stock," said Dominica to Nate, sopping up tomato sauce with a crust of bread. "No one in that crowd besides Bortnikov of the FSB, the Internal Service, recruits foreigners. The president was a KGB officer. He appreciates the accomplishment." "But there's added risk," said Nate. "If word leaks out, for instance, that CIA knows the North Koreans are using U.S. railgun technology, you're immediately compromised as the obvious source. Moscow's got too many ears in Washington." Dominica poured two more glasses of wine. "If your people cannot keep secrets, perhaps I should not tell you secrets." "That's a fine solution," said Nate. "Well, then tell Benford the Prozmadviat the information." "How do you say it?" "Compartment the intelligence," said Nate, who was fluent in Russian. "In Washington, that means only 1,000 people will read your reports. The Air Force, Navy, Department of Energy, ODNI, DIA, NSC, FBI, and half the committees on Capitol Hill. We have a single leak, you'd be on the center's short list of suspects in a week.
And then I suppose you'd get your wish for me to defect, said Dominica, smiling.
From the beginning, for 7 years, she vowed that she'd never accept exfiltration. She was spying to save her Russia, and nothing else mattered. She would not contemplate fleeing. Nate knew the higher she rose in the SVR, the more exclusive her reporting would become, and the more likely she could be compromised by a leak from Washington. She had to keep a low profile, and CIA had to increasingly obfuscate that she was the source of exceptional reporting. To the extreme annoyance of Benford, Nate had been preaching for a year that they should exfiltrate Dominica before she was compromised. She'd had two close calls, and once had even been interrogated in Lefortovo prison after an operational flap. She'd survived that ordeal and been cleared, but Moscow teemed with counterintelligence bloodhounds, jealous rivals, and political enemies who would relish destroying a competitor, especially the lissom Igorova, the rising star. Nate argued that losing her would be a dereliction of their duty to keep her safe, and it would be debilitating to future CIA recruitments worldwide. Plus, even in safe retirement, she would be an invaluable observer and a useful operational advisor. Gable and Forsyth disagreed with Nate, but provisionally understood, having themselves extracted blown agents before. But Benford was furious that Nate was rocking the boat and distracting the asset with his mewling arguments. Simon was old school. Run your assets and gather the intel until the bitter end. Then extract them if possible. If the agent got the chop, it was the hard reality of operations. Benford's operational catechism was codified in an age when an agent could climb over the Berlin Wall or wait for a rubber raft on a Baltic beach to escape the Iron Curtain. Now moles were caught in cyber stings and by drone surveillance and facial recognition software. The tenets of espionage were immutable. Go forth and steal secrets, but technology was changing the game. It didn't help that Nate, despite an unreal gift for denied area ops and surveillance detection, was the junior officer in the quartet of officers who oversaw the Diva case, and thus, despite the tradition of civilian informality in CIA that belied its wartime military OSS roots, should have known to speak only when spoken to. They all knew Nate was spoony over Dominica and dreamed of settling down with her behind a white picket fence, but the Diva case was too valuable to consider pulling the plug. Gable advised Nate with characteristic candor.
"Listen up, rookie," he said. "You recruited her because she had access. Now her access may reach all the way to the top. You pitched her and put her in harness. Now you're her handler, and it's all on you. You use everything in your limited bag of tricks to keep her alive and productive. Everything. Anything. But she's an asset, and you run her like a pro. You got it? Now go put on your big boy pants and shut the fuck up."
Dominica took the dishes in, came back out, and sat on his lap.
"I don't want you to worry," she said. "There will be hundreds of people in Moscow who will read the same reports I give you, providing plenty of cover. And I'll be the one investigating any leaks. I will be the Russian Benford."
Nate shook his head like a dog.
"You're saying that I'm sleeping with the Russian Benford? Better get off my lap. The image will stay with me for months, maybe years."
Dominica laughed and ignored him.
"I will travel quarterly to Vienna to debrief Academician Ri. My sparrow, Ioana, is relocating there to be close to him to keep him calm and to rent a place nearby where we can meet.
We can discuss the case and you can lecture me, and I will continue to, how do you say it, straighten you out? Vipravliat?"
"You're going to straighten me out," said Nate, pulling her close. "I'm the handler here. I'm sure you remember."
"In some circumstances, I become the handler," said Dominica, lifting his t-shirt over his head. "And yes, I will straighten you out."
She deftly pulled the drawstring of his trousers, lifted her skirt, and sat back on his lap, wiggling to seat herself more deeply on him.
"Are you straightened out?" she whispered.
She rocked back and forth, moaning softly, Nate's face buried in her bosom. Then the dried-out, flimsy wicker chair fell apart, dumping them on the still-warm marble of the warped little balcony.
Farther north, the gods on Mount Olympus, looking down from above the alluvial pans of Thessaly, might have said this was a portent of things to come. They moved onto the bed, laughing, Nate holding a bruised elbow. Dominica rested her head on his shoulder. It had been a short time together, yet she was full of bien-être, a contentment, a tender proximity with Nate that she had not felt during other hurried and dangerous meetings. Perhaps it was the brassy Aegean sun, the salt air, and lying in bed with him, smelling his body, and the wisterias and watching the hummingbirds. Nate laughed as Dominica scolded them in Russian, showing the little birds the correct technique for drawing nectar from a stamen. Halfway through her demonstration, he had stopped laughing and was bucking his hips off the mattress. The bullfrog horn of the night fairy from Rhodes bellowed congratulations from the sea.
Dusk, surcease. The kerosene lantern attracted a giant emperor moth, silver wings printed with spots as luminous as owl's eyes, and it dive-bombed around the flame, casting shadows as big as bats on the walls. Dominica propped herself on one arm, and Nate made her repeat the next contact skeds for Vienna in a month, with preliminary and secondary meeting sites, recognition paroles, and countersigns, alternates and safety signals, including brush passes with Ioana, who would be a cutout.
This would be an important follow-up debrief to hear more about the NOCO nuke program and see if they could develop any identifiable information on the U.S. source of the technology leak.
I wish you would let someone else meet the Korean in Vienna, said Nate, worrying the bone one last time. Surely you can designate another officer, someone who speaks Korean or someone who knows weapons design.
We talked about this for 2 days, said Dominica. Why would I do that? It would be illogical. I told you this will help me politically. I'm more likely to receive the promotion that Putin...
You won't get the promotion if you're in the cellars of Butyrka, with a strap around your neck, all because of this obsession with revenge and this stupid jihad you're waging against them all. You're poised at the pinnacle. You're too stubborn to realize that you can hurt them 100-fold by just being director of SVR and keeping a low profile. He felt her stiffen beside him. Dominica got out of bed, wrapped a cotton skirt around her naked body, and started stuffing her few belongings into a shoulder bag. Nate recognized the flashing eyes and flared nostrils.
Where are you going? We're leaving tomorrow morning, he said.
Jihad? Obsessed? Stupid? Shouted Dominica. That is what you think of me, of what I'm doing? Zopa, asshole. I'll die for my country before I sit still and watch them rob us blind. Thank you for your prednost.
What are you talking about? I'm devoted to you more than anyone. I want you to survive.
By giving up and running? Poshelti, piss off. I'm catching the bus to town.
She jammed her feet into flats and slung her bag over her shoulder. Nate got out of bed.
It's pitch black out there. You'll walk off a ledge in the dark. Let me get a flashlight.
Ishezni, get lost,
she yelled and slammed the door and started crunching down the goat path in the dark. Nate threw on pants and flip-flops, grabbed a flashlight, and ran to catch her. She was crying silently as he held her arm and shined the light at their feet. She wouldn't look at him as they stood in the dark under an olive tree, waiting for the late 122 bus, which eventually wheezed around the bend in the road and pulled to a stop. As the doors swung open, Nate expected to see Gable driving and Benford sitting disapprovingly in the back row.
Call when you arrive in Vienna, said Nate as the doors hissed shut in his face.
The bus ground out of sight toward Glyfada, where she would take a taxi to her embassy.
She's changed in the last few years, hot-headed and impossible, uncontrollable as an agent and sure to get caught soon. Some clandestine meeting, some agent handling, some Romeo.
He could hear Gable already. Congratulations, rookie. You just hit bottom and started digging.
Langley. They were gathered in the small, chaotic conference room of Venford's CID Counterintelligence Division, the gray fabric covered and soundproof walls of which were adorned with a row of framed photographs of previous chiefs of CID in an unsettling chronological sequence all the way around the room, like a ghoulish martyr's wall in a Christian catacomb.
Photos from the 60s were sepia-toned with forgotten Ivy Leaguers in thin ties, JFK years. Kodachrome photos from subsequent decades depicted CID chiefs with hipster sideburns and vapid smiles, Carter, expressions of guilty calculation, Nixon, and the thousand-yard stares of hemispheric liberators, Reagan. The final digital photos were of the modern generation of CID chiefs with expressions of mystified alarm, Clinton, Bush. At the end of the row hung the photograph of the most recently retired CID director during the modern era, a chuff famous for his implacable conceit. The U.S. flag in the room had with malice been moved partially in front of this photo, so only a single eye of the fomite peered around the fabric, rendering him even creepier in memory than he had been in person. There was no remaining wall space for any additional frames of future ex-chiefs and rumors of commissioning a ceiling fresco depicting a cherubic, bare-assed Benford with a tiny bow and arrow were up until now unsubstantiated. Like all of Benford's personal spaces, the conference table was messy, cluttered with paper, coffee mugs, and a donut box. Rolled-up maps were stacked in a corner, and a pulled-down projection screen was torn down the center and patched with duct tape. Two shattered flat-screen monitors were discarded in the far corner of the room, along with the shards of a U.S. Navy coffee mug, which almost certainly had been the projectile that had destroyed at least one of the monitors. Benford, Gable, Forsyth, and Nash were at one end. Hersey, the tall ectomorph tech chief, came in with two notebooks and sat at the far end. Rugged, rangy, and leather tough, Hersey looked like someone who should be on the prairie mending barbed wire fence or using a Berdizo castrator tool on bull calves instead of spending a year in a lab concocting a chemical acid fog sprayed at night by stealth drone to embrittle North Korean missile gantries or developing wrist-worn fitness monitors molded out of Semtex that could be detonated in Dubai from a laboratory in Maryland. An engineer by training, Hersey knew about railguns, plus he didn't take guff from Benford, and Gable liked him, so he was read into everything, including the Diva case. He was known in the agency simply as Hersey. Only the mavens and personnel knew his given name was Gale, and they never revealed anything. Hersey looked around Benford's squalid conference room, ran a finger across the crumb-covered table, and contemplated the surrounding detritus. "I thought the Hindenburg crashed in Lakehurst, New Jersey," said Hersey, who could get away with being a wise-ass. Benford blinked once. Sitting at the other end of the table taking notes was Benford's new assistant, Lucius Westfall, a WMD analyst transferred from the Directorate of Intelligence to the Directorate of Operations, one of scores of CIA director-mandated sabbaticals designed to forcefully integrate DI analysts with DO operators, which was in most cases like partnering the pastor's daughters with bargees at a barn dance. Westfall was blonde, thin-faced, with wire-rimmed glasses that tended to fog when he spoke publicly or talked to pretty women. It was demanding enough to work for Simon Benford, but Westfall constantly had to decode the aboriginal patois of the operations directorate. These ops officers were unintelligible when incessantly talking about bumps, dangles, peddlers, old whores, burn notices, drops, caches, headhunters, scalps, dry cleaning, rabbits, chicken feed, barium enemas, 201s, PRQs, natural reverses, flipping, fluffing, fluttering, and a million other mysteries. As terrifying, Westfall had to weather the depredations of the hulking Marty Gable, who Westfall was convinced had once been a serial killer from Kansas.
"Make sure you take good notes, Lucius," said Gable, mispronouncing his name with a fake French accent. Gable's particular style of mentoring a newbie colleague fell somewhere between drill instructor and a chariot driver in the hippodrome. Gable ironically had himself also been dragooned from his rough-and-tumble Africa division to be Benford's unlikely deputy. CID was a spooky counterintelligence shop, typically staffed with brilliant, quirky introverts who worked in the dark with the shades drawn. Outsiders called it the Island of Broken Toys. Benford wanted Gable less as a substantive deputy and more as someone who could solve unstable, delicate foreign crises wherever they developed, a function Marty demurely characterized as breaking the dishes. Diva also idolized Gable. He could talk her down out of the tree when she went into her increasingly more frequent conniptions about Camo, risk-taking, and security.
Benford gaveled the meeting to order with some solemnity for which he was known in Washington, London, Ottawa, Canberra, Bonn, Paris, Rome, and Tel Aviv by slamming a file folder on the table with his trademark invocation.
Jesus fucking Christ! If Diva's intel is right, we have a fucking fuckwad selling fucking secrets on the rail fucking gun to North Korea.
Just back from Athens, Nash read off a paper. Diva just reported by Shrek this morning. The SVR has encrypted this North Korean professor Ri Soo-young, Pechka, which means furnace in Russian, he said. Gable grunted.
Furnace, huh? Dictionary would take up less space and wouldn't eat all the donuts, he said.
Nate slid the box of glazed donuts across the conference table. You're welcome, said Nate. I bought the donuts for everyone. Thought it would be okay to eat one.
Gable lifted the lid of the box. You buy donuts and you don't even bring an assortment. No chocolate? No jelly?
Benford stirred in his chair. Can we concentrate on what appears to be the transfer of U.S. Navy electromagnetic railgun technology to the North Korean nuclear program?
Forsyth put down a copy of Diva's report. How did the Nokos get this technology? Said Forsyth. The RGB can't tie their own shoes. All they normally do is shoot coup plotters inside their own country. You're telling me they're running an American source in-country? No way.
Someone's passing the technology, said Hersey. The translated Korean document Diva provided has verbatim U.S. terminology. Conduction path, ionized gas, compact pulsed power. The Nokos aren't coming up with that on their own.
It's gotta be Beijing, said Gable. I bet the MSS popped some California peacenik working in a Navy lab who's dedicated to Trans-Pacific Harmony, or a zit-faced contractor in DOD who wants a Corvette, or a weapons officer on board a frigate who's in love with a Chia Pet from Shanghai who's keeping his personal railgun on pulsed power.
Westfall squirmed in his seat. Benford saw it and pointed at him. Westfall, you have a view on the issue? Gable slid the donut box down the table as collegial encouragement to speak up. Westfall let the lid of the box drop when he saw Gable had eaten the last two donuts and the box was empty.
I don't think Beijing wants Pyongyang to have the bomb, Westfall said. The Chinese think they still control the Nokos with food shipments and military aid. They like that the West comes begging for help in moderating North Korean behavior. And they ultimately know that once Pyongyang has a reliable nuke and a delivery system, their pit bull has slipped the leash and is likely to do anything. Even against them.
I looked it up. Flight time of a basic Rodong-1 ballistic missile for the 800 kilometers from Sohai Satellite Launch Center to Tiananmen Square is about 5 minutes, not even time for the Politburo to kiss one another goodbye. Nope, China doesn't want them to have the bomb. There was silence around the table. The kid wasn't dumb.
A real Ulysses P. Grant, said Gable. So who do you think's running our railgun mole?
Westfall looked over at Nate. Diva's the only one who can tell us that, he said. But if she can't find a name pretty darn quick and Pyongyang figures out how to squeeze a uranium device into a warhead, the Seattle Space Needle is going to be ground zero. Nate's Aegean Green Beans. Top and tail green beans. Mix minced garlic, parsley, dill, mint, salt, and pepper. Layer thin sliced onions on the bottom of a Dutch oven. Cover with a layer of crushed tomatoes, beans, the herbs, abundant olive oil, another layer of onions, tomatoes, beans, herbs, and olive oil. Finish with a layer of onions and drizzle with more olive oil. Simmer covered until beans are very soft and tender. Season and add lemon juice. Serve warm or at room temperature.
Chapter 4. Stealing Secrets. Alexander Larson, the sitting director of CIA, was the first DCIA in 30 years to have come up through the operational ranks. He was a Mustang, like the OSS vintage directors who led the agency in the 50s and the 60s. Before the unrelieved string of successors selected from the military, or from the unctuous halls of Congress, or from the ranks of the Directorate of Intelligence, and tried their hands at directing an organization the arcane mission of which they imperfectly understood and had never experienced firsthand. Some directors were disasters, some of them unmitigated disasters,
and a precious few achieved a certain synergy with the notoriously skeptical and ungovernable workforce at Langley before they left. The confirmation of veteran ops officer Alex Larson as DCIA broke the drought. Alex Larson had gone through training at the farm in the early 70s with Simon Benford. Larson, the smooth extrovert, became friends with Benford, the irascible misanthrope, the result of an unlikely personal chemistry that had endured 30 years. It was logical that their disparate personalities would push Alex into the overseas clandestine service and the business of recruitment of foreign assets, and that Benford naturally would gravitate to the slough of counterintelligence and counterespionage. Geographical separation over the years did not dull the friendship, which automatically renewed itself whenever their paths crossed. Now Larson was DCIA. He knew his rumpled friend was brilliant and had the tenacity of a pit bull, albeit with a malocluded bite. Benford consulted with him often. The past administration had selected Larson as DCIA in recognition of his moral rectitude, bureaucratic acumen, and top-flight recruitments which Benford, over the years, had supported by vetting the assets as they came online. 65-year-old Larson looked the DCIA part. He was short, a bit stout, wore ginger-colored tortoiseshell eyeglasses, and sported what Benford called an Alan Dulles wannabe mustache. This, along with thinning white hair and white eyebrows so bushy that subordinates had to resist the temptation to run a comb through them, made him look like a college professor. But he was every inch the operator, and the troops respected him. Larson was not popular with the current White House, or with the derivative progressives on the National Security Council, the 20-something English majors who were advising POTUS on Mideast policy. DCIA Larson, moreover, had obliquely contradicted his predecessor's statement during the latter's farewell foreign tour. "We don't steal secrets," the outgoing DCIA had said of CIA intelligence collection to an Allied liaison audience. "Everything we do is consistent with U.S. law. We uncover, we discover, we reveal, we obtain, we elicit, we solicit." Asked about his predecessor's statement at a closed session of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, SSCI, Larson unsmilingly and without a trace of irony had replied to the senators, "Fair enough. An asset, for instance, discovers the existence of a Russian mole in NATO headquarters. CIA case officers solicits the info. The asset then reveals it, and thereby CIA obtains perishable counterintelligence information." Partisan snitches reported the disloyal comment promptly, but Alexander Larson was not fired. He could not be fired. The reason was Copper Finn. During his 14 years in the operational field, Larson had built the Copper Finn espionage network, the massive, pervasive penetration of the entire state aerospace design, construction, and testing combine in the Russian Federation. Larson had personally recruited the first two Russian principal agents years earlier, one in India, the other in Brazil, who in turn had themselves recruited subsources in the Sukhoi, Mikoyan, Ilyushin, Tupolev, and Yakovlev design entities, all of which in 2006 had merged into OAK, the United Aircraft Corporation, located in the Krasnoselsky district in the central Moscow Okrug. Larson's Copper Finn agents regularly emptied the top-secret vaults of OAK to report on the advanced capabilities of fourth- and fifth-generation Russian fighters, such as the Su-27, the MiG-29, and the new Sukhoi PAK-FA. The U.S. Air Force was ecstatic. The administration's intention to eventually jettison Alex Larson in favor of a DCIA more conformable to the White House's pigeon-hearted foreign policy was stopped cold by howls from the Pentagon after the acquisition through the Copper Finn network of the technical parameters of APFAR, the new Russian-phased array radar, an inestimable prize. Next came the delivery of an actual Zvezda KH-35U anti-ship missile, NATO designation Kayak, but nicknamed the Harpoonsky because of its similarities to the U.S. Harpoon missile. Zvezda was brought across the Lithuanian border by a courier in the Copper Finn network who bribed border guards to ignore the tail of the missile protruding from the broken-out back window of his UAZ Patriot, which was the only way he could fit the 520-kilogram, 380-centimeter missile into his compact SUV. Immune from dyspeptic antagonists, DCIA Larson, in consultation with Simon Benford, launched his own active measures campaign against the Putin regime, an offensive long overdue in the eyes of many to repay the Russians in their own coin for 7 decades of disinformation, forgeries, and political meddling that was the Kremlin's stock and trade. Larson became a vocal critic of Vladimir Putin's Russian Federation, testifying in open committee sessions about congenital Russian use of active measures to influence political outcomes, mostly with mediocre results. He increased intel sharing with Allied services, especially in Ukraine and the Baltics, which resulted in several flashy spy arrests of red-faced Russian intel officers. Their identities had been provided by Diva, and Larson had passed along his compliments to her via Benford. The director and Diva had never met. Larson properly left the case in the able hands of Benford and company. After a career of working the Russian target, Larson understood the depredatory worldview of Vladimir Putin and knew that the Kremlin would stop misbehaving only when the costs of Putin's delinquency exceeded the perceived gains. Then came the explosive report. Copperfin Assets smuggled out documentary proof of massive fraud in the Oak Aerospace Consortium. Oak had been set up by President Putin as an open joint stock company combining Russian private and state-owned assets, the lion's share of which disappeared into the pockets of favored cronies. Supported by Benford, Larson pushed the White House and the hand-wringing Department of State to publicize the corruption, citing foreign sources to protect internal assets, to denounce Russia in the United Nations, to levy sanctions on companies selling Russian commercial airliners, and to block any reinstatement of Russia to the G7. Reluctant to antagonize the Kremlin, the White House dithered, but finally acted at the urging of a bumptious Congress that had been briefed by the DCIA. Alex Larson was everywhere in town, pressing official Washington to bestir itself. Benford huddled with Alex in Larson's office. "Finally, this is an opening to discommode these coarse Slav fuckers," Benford said. "We're collecting comprehensive technical and military intelligence, and the negative international publicity will cow Putin at least for a while. I only wish we could more accurately predict his reaction, handling a cornered snake and so on, if you follow the metaphor." "As I recall, your metaphors used to be markedly more erudite," said Alex, deadpan. "Perhaps Diva will soon have better access to Putin's plans and intentions if she becomes director of SVR, assuming, of course, that your handling of her is as inspired as you claim it to be." Benford did not smile. "You can be sure that even in the absence of your signature flamboyant Rococo operational style, the Diva case is being managed securely." Larson laughed. "Is the young officer still primary handler? What was his name?" "Nash, Nathaniel," said Benford. "He's possibly going to assist the Australians in the Hong Kong operation I briefed you on last week. Marty Gable will hold Diva's hand in the interim." Larson's nose was too good. "Any trouble?" Benford shrugged. "The recruiting case officer and Diva have a relationship that falls slightly outside the usual parameters." "Meaning what?" asked Alex. "They are in love and are intimate whenever circumstances allow," said Benford. "Until now I have stayed my hand from firing Nash. I assess his separation from the service would have a significant effect on Diva's production." "How significant?" said Alex. "As in she would quit. With Nash in Hong Kong for a few weeks and Gable to steady the asset, there are no immediate concerns." The two men thought alike, and the matter, and Nash's future, was shelved for now. Larson opened the file on his desk that contained Benford's script for tomorrow's briefing of POTUS and the NSC Principals Committee on CIA's continued covert action campaign against the Kremlin. He was silent as he read. "One misses the field," he said, looking up. Benford opened his file, too. "The organization needs you behind this desk. You've had your debauch overseas for 30 years. Now you have to turn this pig's breakfast back into a spy service." "Run through your notes for me," said Alex. Benford spoke briefly and succinctly.
This brief was a matter of reassuring the jittery U.S. president and ensuring continued Pentagon support. Jamming a stick into Putin's spokes at this time was critical, given his brazen interference on the world stage. He was emboldened by confusion and anxiety among Western governments. Publicly embarrassing the Kremlin would disrupt multiple Russian active measures in the Baltics, Europe, and in places like Montenegro. Russia's moribund economy would be trebly stung by any publicized malfeasance within Oak, scaring away investors, reducing customers for Russian military material, and complicating Kremlin adventurism in Africa, Latin America, and the resource-rich Arctic. Twisting the Russian bear's tail abroad, moreover, would distract the Kremlin and thus protect valuable assets such as Copperfin. The Russians would be driven frantic in the face of withering international disparagement. The DCIA would politely insist that POTUS could not ignore the opportunity and must not remain quiescent. "We'll see how it works on him," said Alex. "At least the top brass will support me." "Don't worry, this will stir the hornet's nest," said Benford. He was correct, but he would set in motion events no one could have remotely predicted. The Russian reaction to the first American exposé was to cry provocation. Ironic, the inveterate plotters always assumed their own misfortune was naturally the result of an outside plot. But the international embarrassment and the innate Russian paranoia of being laughed at as manure-speckled kulaks and relegated to second-world status drove Vladimir Putin into a rage, in part fueled by fright. This was how leaders were toppled. He summoned Gorelikov to his personal, most isolated dacha in the town of Solovyevka, 130 kilometers outside St. Petersburg on the shore of Lake Komsomolsk. He wanted privacy and to be away from the prying eyes of his siloviki. They would smell his panic like the pack hunters they were. He trusted Gorelikov. "How did work leak of financial arrangements at Oak?" raved Putin, pacing the room, kicking the snarling head of a Siberian tiger rug each time he passed. They were in the dacha's large main room, redolent with wood smoke, decorated in rustic style with leather couches and chairs scattered about, and a vintage 1936 7.62 caliber Tula hunting rifle above the roaring fireplace. Outside the panoramic picture windows, uncharacteristically lavish in a typical lakeside dacha, snow covered the shoreline and dusted the pines, but the black water of the lake had not yet frozen. Gorelikov did not want to excite the president any more than he was now. It is likely that the corporation's foreign contacts, bankers, salesmen, and government buyers, were the sources of these defamations, he said, quoting the news releases. Putin looked at Gorelikov like a week-old sturgeon with milky eyes. "No. We have a Gemroy, a big problem. Someone inside Oak, someone who knows the books." Gorelikov had by choice never prospered from the bacchanal of corruption in the Kremlin, and was secretly amused now that the spoils of greed had stung the Tsar. "There are 30,000 employees working at Oak," said Gorelikov. "We'd have to tear the place apart." He took a breath. "Ignore the accusations. They will be forgotten in a week." Putin swore. Those specific accusations were in fact forgotten the next morning, when a message from Magnet was relayed from the center to the dacha's commo room, reporting that an intact Zvezda KH-35U anti-ship missile had been delivered to the Dahlgren Division Naval Surface Warfare Center test facility in Virginia for evaluation of guidance, propulsion, and warhead systems. Putin swore again. "Bliad, son of a bitch. So you think this will be forgotten in a week?" he said to Gorelikov. "Not only is Washington defaming us on the world stage, but also CIA appears to have at least one asset inside Oak." Gorelikov chose his words carefully. "We sell Zvezda missiles to India, Brazil, and Vietnam. The Americans could have acquired an export model from a third-world agent without our top-of-the-line seeker head and telemetry." Putin gave him another fishy stare. He had trusted Gorelikov since knowing him from law school, recognized his brilliance, and appreciated his analytic mind. He also knew Anton was not corrupt or susceptible or power-hungry. He would never covet Putin's throne. Most important, Putin recognized Gorelikov's proclivity for and love of nanesenya uvechya, covert mayhem. Just as a chess player relishes organizing defenses, traps, attacks, and feints to achieve checkmate, Gorelikov reveled in concocting an intricate intriga just for the sheer joy of causing havoc. In this, he was unmatched. Bortnikov of FSB or Patrushev of his security council were accomplished schemers, but no one was like Gorelikov.
"Enough of the rationalizations," said Putin. "I want a solution. Washington and CIA are making fools of us. The loudmouths in the Moscow press and on the street will spread the word and agitate."
Gorelikov shrugged. "Repina especially," he said, referring to one of the most vocal anti-Putin, anti-corruption dissidents recently noticed in the West and raising money as a result.
"Suka, bitch, forget her. I want Tredstvo. I want a remedy," said Putin, leaving the room,
and Gorelikov to contemplate the snow-laden landscape and the ink-black water. The next evening, Putin lighted two thick candles in 18th-century red, gold, and turquoise cloisonné candlesticks on a plank table placed near the dacha's picture windows. The rest of the room was dark, only the light of the burning logs in the vast fireplace cast additional flickering shadows around the room. Two steaming bowls of kormia, Russian lamb stew, were in front of them with two heels of black bread for dipping into the gravy. The steward serving them had withdrawn. Putin and Gorelikov both drank tea from a hissing samovar on a side table. Tonight was no night for vodka. The wind had kicked up after dusk, and frozen crystals of snow adrift in the utterly black night scratched invisibly against the glass. With the roaring hearth, the hiss of the samovar, and the storm raging outside, this was the devil's waiting room. The two men were sitting at either end of the table eating stew and looking at each other, as if waiting for Shaitan to join them. "The Americans are timorous," said Gorelikov. "They avoid conflict in the foreign field. They ignore their allies and coddle those who oppose them." Putin slurped a spoonful of stew. "And yet, we see this attack against the reputation of Russia and the calumny directed at me." His voice shook. "This is my point," said Gorelikov. "This campaign does not originate from the Craven White House. This comes from CIA. It is their brand of active measures directed back at us."
"Why does it come now?"
Gorelikov wiped his mouth and leaned forward. "It could be for 100 reasons, all of which we know well. We ourselves concocted a legend to camouflage the intelligence Snowden brought with him. Or we send a dispatched volunteer to discredit a genuine defector. We focus criticism elsewhere to mask the existence of a high-level agent or network." Putin set his spoon down.
"We can discuss American motives all day," he said. "And we can speculate about how many moles we have in place in each other's pantries. But it does not solve the problem."
His voice rose.
"It is my reputation, my prestige, and my public image."
"Which is more important than any spy stealing our secrets," thought Gorelikov. Gorelikov commiserated. "The director of CIA is Alexander Larsen," said Gorelikov. "He is a legend among the operational cadre in CIA's ops directorate. He is also the first ops-trained DCIA since the mid-70s, and is aggressive. Reports from Resident Turi indicate CIA is ramping up activity worldwide. CIA officers are pitching our officers in scores of foreign capitals. For everyone who reports a hostile pitch, how many do not? We cannot know, but we must assume a small percentage accept recruitment. Igorova in line KR also regularly reports operational flaps and ambushes, as though a mole in SVR is advising the Americans."
"We have our own triumphs," said Putin distractedly.
"Of course. I'm only emphasizing that DCIA Alexander Larsen,
is an activist director who is not only accelerating operational tempo against us in the field, but also, in my view, putting together a covert action to stimulate regime change in our country, modeled after their successes in Ukraine and Georgia. He must have leverage to persuade the administration to permit it, perhaps with support from congressional hawks. Gorelikov spoke calmly. You know I speak openly to you. Putin nodded. I say to you with confidence that Larsen and his aide